From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest on the possible government shutdown, we'll hear from Senator Ed Markey.
The Republicans just have to accept that they now run all branches of government, and they have a responsibility to be the leaders. And the president so far has abdicated that responsibility. Stop, Mr. President, stop holding these kids hostage.
Our Week in Review panel will take a look at that and the future of GE and Amazon in Boston. Also today, Pope Francis says victims of sexual abuse in South America are slandering a Chilean bishop. And a new documentary about playwright Lorraine Hansberry and her transformative work, A Raisin in the Sun.
Serious drama. Drama that has at least the objective of making a larger statement about life. I think sooner or later has to become involved in its time.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, which means time for the Week in Review. But the Week in Review has to do with news going on right now. So we'll start with the impending government shutdown. Last night, the House of Representatives approved a funding bill largely on party lines, and now it's in the Senate's hands. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor earlier today.
They will see which senators vote to shove aside veterans, military families, and vulnerable children to hold the entire country hostage. Hold the entire country hostage until we pass an immigration bill they haven't even written yet.
Well, here's how Democratic Senator Dick Durbin responded.
The best that the Republican leader in the Senate can offer us is another Band-Aid, another 4 weeks of temporary funding, a wasteful gesture, a wasteful exercise, and he knows it.
Well, we've got a terrific panel to talk about these things today. But first, let's go straight to Washington, and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey joins us now. Senator Markey, welcome back to the show.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So, what's going on in the Senate right now? What's your view about whether or not we're going to have a government shutdown come midnight tonight?
Well, Chuck Schumer just left the meeting with Donald Trump down in the White House. Obviously, Donald Trump now realizes increasingly that he is going to be the person who is blamed if the government shuts down. All of the polling is now showing that. And so hopefully this is the opening that we've been waiting for, although it's 9 hours before the government does shut down. But there's no question that it's now up to the president to say to the most radical right-wing elements of his party that he's going to, in fact, compromise. He's going to reach an agreement, and he will convene the meeting, because ultimately it has to be the president, Mitch McConnell, and Paul Ryan in a room with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Mm. That's how we will ultimately get an agreement.
Well, so you mentioned the fact that Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, was in this meeting with President Donald Trump. He just left the White House about an hour ago, in the last hour, made a quick statement to reporters. So here's what Senator Schumer said.
Long and detailed meeting. We discussed all of the major outstanding issues. We made some progress, but we still have a good number of disagreements. The discussions will continue.
And Senator Markey, as you mentioned, there's some 9 hours left. You heard the tape we played a little earlier from Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calling out Democrats for, in his words, holding the entire country hostage over the continuing resolution. I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, my response is obviously that the Republicans control the Senate. They control the House of Representatives. They control the presidency. So we're not the ones holding the country hostage. It's the Republicans who are refusing to allow Democrats into the room. They are putting together bills with no debate, no amendments, no Democrats in the room, and then they bring it out onto the floor of the House and Senate, basically saying take it or leave it. But in take it or leave it, they also leave out protection for Dreamers, funding for opioids, funding for community health centers, and the Democrats are saying 4 months into the fiscal year, only 8 months left to go, let's finish these issues. Let us not have it herky-jerky, move month to month with no permanent resolution, and also let's send a signal to the Defense Department to military personnel that we're giving them a permanent budget for the year. It's up to the Republicans to come to the table in order to achieve all of those goals.
Yeah. You know, to get some facts straight here, I mean, I've been hearing in the past couple of days a lot of back and forth about CHIP, right? The Children's Health Insurance Program, which is, to use kind of a crass term, it's one of the bargaining chips. Forgive me for the terrible pun. In this debate over of a continuing resolution in the government, but if I remember correctly, if I've got my facts straight, I mean, CHIP expired. CHIP funding expired more than 3 months ago, right? So it didn't seem as if there was this much urgency on the GOP side several months ago, when this program that funds millions of kids of healthcare lost its funding.
Right. In order to give predictability for Massachusetts, for every state that relies upon CHIP funding for the child population, the federal government began its new fiscal year on October 1st. The Republicans refused to, in fact, sit down with us to work out a budget for the year. The same thing was true with community health centers. The same thing was true with opioid funding. And the same thing was true with DACA. Then we had another extension of the continuing resolution in November. Then we had another extension in December. And now we have yet another one that they want here in January for another 4 weeks. Well, all of these important vital services and protections are still not resolved. And CR for Republicans really means can't resolve. And it's not can't resolve with Democrats, it's they can't resolve it in their own party, because the Freedom Caucus, the right wing, keeps pulling McConnell, Ryan, Lindsey Graham, and the president out of the room. Just stop compromising. And as a result, there's a paralysis which has taken place. But all of these programs, as a result, jeopardized.
But on the other hand, the Freedom Caucus, just before the House vote yesterday on the CR, they said they'd be on board. So they may have made some noise, but they ultimately voted in favor for it. Is the same thing going to happen on the Senate side?
No, they voted for the Republican budget. They did not vote for anything that had any Democrat in the room. So their compromise was that with the Republican leadership, they agreed to vote for the Republican bill. But compromise in the minds of the Freedom Caucus with Democrats is capitulation. They won't accept any compromise. Mm. They won't hear any of our concerns. And that's DACA, it's opioids, it's community health centers. All of that has yet to be in the room and negotiated with Republicans who can get Republican votes to then pass it on the floor of the House and the Senate.
So, Senator Markey, I'm mindful that there's a lot going on Capitol Hill right now, and things could be changing even in the time period that you and I have been talking. But I have one more question for you. Over the course of this week, I've actually received several, maybe half a dozen emails from listeners who think that we're spending too much time talking about this government shutdown, and that they recall in years past when the government has temporarily not been able to come up with a CR and shut down for a little while, and they said, we've survived. So I'm just wondering, for those folks, what do you think is at stake if we can't get a CR passed by midnight tonight?
There's a fundamental responsibility that each of us have, including the president, when we run for office. And that is to make sure that the government works. What is happening now is the Republican paradox is that they don't believe in government, but they have to run for office in order to make sure that the government doesn't work. Well, that calls into question, actually, the premise of this constitutional system of government, which we have. And the American people want their government to work. They don't want us to have this kind of paralysis that results in hostages being taken, child health or DACA or community health centers, as a part of a process that is nonsensical. And so I would say to them that there's a lot at stake here, and it includes the normal constitutional functioning of the federal government towards the goal of ensuring that everything that is important to the American people be completed in an orderly fashion. And the president is failing his on-the-job constitutional law class at every test. Mm. He needs a remedial course. He is going up to Pennsylvania yesterday to campaign for a congressional candidate. The rest of the time, he's tweeting out criticisms of the Republicans for talking about a compromise on child health or criticizing Democrats, you know, for what they want. He's the president. In the musical Hamilton, there's a great scene, a great song, In the Room Where It Happens. And Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison, they go in a room, In the Room Where It Happens. They cut their big deal. Well, that's what the president has to accept.
Yeah.
He, and only he, can put together the room where it happens, and he has to bring in the Democrat and Republican leaders, and then we can resolve it. And that is what the Constitution intended. That's what Hamilton was all about. And that's what the American people want right now. And there may be some who think that it's acceptable, but I think the overwhelming majority of Americans oppose. And the polling says that 48% of Americans will blame Trump and only 28% the Democrats. 87% of Americans want a DACA fix to be passed. So I think there may be some people who don't mind and think that this is business as usual, but I don't think that's how ordinary voters, ordinary people, view what is now happening.
Well, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, let's turn now to our Week in Review panelists. Joining us today, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. She's also a political consultant as well. Arlene, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Meghna. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. Also with us, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, good to have you.
Good to be with
as
you.
As well. Aside from the fact that Ed Markey has seen Hamilton, which I haven't yet, so he's hipper than I am. Arlene, your first response to what you just heard, and also just the fact that it does seem like we're sort of half a dozen hours away from potentially a government shutdown.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. I mean, this is the fourth stopgap bill that we've dealt with in the last several months. And, you know, the art of the deal when it comes to government is really the art of negotiation and compromise. You can't have everything you want. And the president has unilaterally rejected the bipartisan proposal placed before him. So has Mitch McConnell. So the president's got to do what he claims he's so good at, which is negotiate a concession at this point, just like the Democrats are going to have to concede on things that they want.
Jim, is that harder than that's easy for us to say. But when you've got the Freedom Caucus way out there on your right, the implacable Freedom Caucus, it seems, as Ed Markey would describe them, is negotiating that deal harder than we think?
Look, I would observe a couple things. One is that I thought Schumer's tone was much more hopeful than I would have thought was possible. First thing. Second thing is I take the senator's point on compromise taking two. The one thing I would note is that when the Democrats are in power, they say we want a clean continuing resolution. And when the Republicans are there, they want a clean continuing resolution.
And nothing in Washington
and
is ever clean.
It never happens that way, right? For the last 20 years, over 100 continuing resolutions. We've had shutdowns 18 times in 40 years. A lot of this is the result of the fact the budget making process is broken. We've had a real budget process four times in 40 years. One out of 10 years. Mm. Things are broken there. And it doesn't help that we have people who are probably not best suited to making compromises who are there too. But we already had a broken system. Layer onto that the partisanship and several personalities, and it makes it very hard.
Yeah.
You know, Meghna, it was interesting to hear what you said about people writing to you and not concerned about the government shutdown, because the reality is that government shutdowns cost money. They never save money. And they cause collateral damage. You know, local businesses, small businesses, particularly those that are predicated on tourism traffic, can get harmed in this severely when you have a government shutdown.
Right. I mean, I've got some other sort of broad-based numbers here. Because there is no agreement on DACA, that's, you know, up to somewhere around 700,000 young people who are still hanging in the balance. The lack of agreement on CHIP so far, 9 million children are on the Children's Health Insurance Program. If they can't get a CR pass, that could mean that 1.3 million active duty members of the United States military could be expected to work without pay. In another aspect of what the government does, 417 national parks could shut down. I mean, we don't really know exactly, you know, what would happen, but these are some of the potential implications.
And even if people do get federal employees do get paid eventually, what do they do in the meantime when the bank comes knocking at the door for their mortgage payment? Do they say, oh, as soon as the government acts, then you can get paid? You know, they're responsible for their bills, whether the government's done the right thing or not.
I want to play another piece of tape, and this is sort of apropos of what you were saying. saying, Jim, a second ago about the broken process. This is Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget for the White House. He was asked by a reporter this morning about why the GOP can't, because the GOP controls the House, the Senate, and the White House, why they can't get a continuing resolution through. And here's what he says.
I have to laugh when people say that, oh, we control the House and the Senate and the White House. Why can't you get this done? You know as well as anybody that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass an appropriations bill, right? You know that.
I know that.
Okay, so, if you only have 51 votes in the Senate, then you have to have Democrat support in order to keep the government, to fund the government.
So it's interesting because Mulvaney in years past has championed previous government shutdowns, but he's making an interesting point there. Arlene, I want to turn that to you. He is pinning on this on the Democrats if they can't get at least 9 to cross the aisle.
Well, It's got to be bipartisan. Schumer rightly pointed out that after having the Democrats agree to 3 previous stopgap measures, if they do this one, there's just no incentive for the Republicans to negotiate in good faith. And apparently that's what's happened now for month after month after month. So, you know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on me. And now that's happened 3 times and you got to draw the line and say, we have to negotiate in good faith. Because the truth of the matter is this happens all the time. It happens in the courts. It happens when you buy a home or a car. It's the way the human beast works. They just got to get it together and do it.
Yeah, Jim, your thoughts on that?
Look, I think it's the ball's up in the air as to who's going to get the blame for this. I think if the Republicans can muster 50-plus in the Senate, it may be seen by the American public, or at least the American public that pays any attention, to be probably more on the Democratic side. And the fact that there is a chip, this chip funding in this, I think there could be a price to pay. By the same token, it doesn't seem that the Republicans can get there. I think that Rand Paul has come out against. Mm-hmm. I think Mike Rounds has come out against. I think Lindsey Graham has come out against. So I think this would be a share of blame to go all the way around. I don't think the Republicans will own all of it. They'll own a lot of it.
Yeah. Maybe I'm being too naive here, but I'm still thinking about what you mentioned about the process being broken. And over the course of this week, I've had this sort of dark knot of cynicism growing in the pit of my stomach, because here we are, right, on Friday, and we have DACA and CHIP and the United States military. Just take those 3, for example. 3, you know, individually incredibly important programs, groups, organizations, what have you, literally being used as pawns against each other by hardcore partisans in Washington. Even just saying that, I know people are going to get mad depending on what your political viewpoint is, because they're going to say it's all just one side's fault or the other. But at the core of it, that's what's happening. Like they're being played against each other. And to me, I don't know, again, I keep thinking maybe it's just because I'm like hopelessly naive, but it's a terrible outcome that we find ourselves in. This should not be how government is done.
No, it shouldn't be. I mean, look, DACA should go through a regular legislative process, and people should have debates, and it should be a piece of legislation that makes a decision. And it should not be done as part of a continuing resolution as to whether you're going to shut the government down or not. Same thing on
unless
the
you have no choice, unless the majority party, who, in this case it happens to be Republicans, unless they refuse to do it in any other form, then this is your only one and only moment of leverage.
Well, then it is fundamentally broken, right? Because we shouldn't be. I mean, but I think your point is well taken, Arlene. But that, again, I think is the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding's a giant mess right now. Okay, well, so they've got, I'm looking at the clock here, it's 3:24, so I can't do that math, 8.5 hours? 8 hours and 40-ish minutes? 8 hours and 20 minutes? I don't know. To see if they can sort this out. So let's hope so. All right. Let's move on now and switch gears entirely and talk a little bit about Boston and the business world, because GE, which now makes Boston its home, is 2017 was a terrible year for GE. Let's just put it that way. Worst performing stock on the Dow. And this week, GE CEO John Flannery said all options are on the table to turn the company around, including a breakup. So what would that mean for Boston? We've got some tape here. This is Ann Klee, GE's Vice President of Boston Development and Operations. She spoke with us here at WBUR, and she says, no worries, Boston. GE's going to keep its promises to the city.
We're doing lots of things already in Boston and the surrounding communities. We've got lots more in the pipeline ready to go. And, you know, that's on top of GE executives really getting involved in the community. GE is massively committed to Boston, and we're thrilled to be here.
Great. But, Jim, what do you think? If the company breaks up, does it make a difference to Boston for as long as they keep their commitments regarding their headquarters?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I think it matters because all the ripple effects that we expected to come out of it, the vendor networks and all the rest, would be impacted, obviously. I'd just like to step back on one thing you asked in the beginning. You said this is a terrible year for GE. And I had a couple of thoughts on that. One is that I think what we realized is that Jeffrey Immelt was somewhere between a disaster for the company in terms of manager and someone who completely killed the Jack Welch mystique. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing is I do think things will get worse before they get better. And if you listen to, well, a couple of things. When a CFO and Jeff Bornstein was pushed out, it seems, in a surprise move, and that they're in their investor call, they were talking about how what they're dealing with right now is regards GE Capital, which was spun off before.
Yep.
They said, we do not believe that the issues rise to the level of securities violations. When I hear that, I say, right. So, I mean, they have restatements of all kinds of issues, and they may have to actually restate their revenues and their earnings. That will drive down their stock further. That may make them a good buy for someone to invest in, too. But it's going to be a rough ride for a while. That's all, the only thing I wanted to say.
Look, it's a great buy right now, even given just its 2017 drop. But I'm glad you mentioned GE Capital, though, because that was part of the Jack Welch mystique was, you know, according to some sort of people who take a more cynical view of him, like he was playing a financial shell game with GE's financial holdings. But Arlene, your thoughts.
Well, it's interesting to hear Jim's perspective from the private sector side. From the public sector side, I find the whole business a little troubling. Firstly, GE has already pushed back the second phase of the opening of two buildings two years further than they had originally promised. And this brings up the whole question about the pros and cons of taxpayer money being used to bolster, and this is my version of it, bolster corporate profits in order to lure a company someplace. And, you know, you always have to ask the question, where does the money come from? Mm-hmm. So if you're taking money from the poor, the sick, the needy to bolster a corporation's profits, in this case it happens to be GE, I think that we need to have certain things in place, a clawback provision, which I understand there may have been something of that akin in there.
And In terms of hiring.
So they can't promise the world and then not deliver. But also I think that we need sort of a reverse prenup where if the corporation abandons the marriage or reneges on their marriage vows, I think they should have to pay triple damages because that money would have been used for something else. It would have been used for people who were desperately needy at the moment, but it was set aside for a corporation, and then the corporation changed its minds or circumstances changed.
Okay, so on the other hand, I'll give a hat tip to Shirley Leung because in the Boston Globe, she was much more bullish about all of this, and she said worst case scenario, the city and state just have a couple of high value pieces of property on their hands, and since Boston is growing, she feels totally confident that someone will come and use it. So she didn't seem so cloudy as you did.
I read her piece, but if you'll notice, her piece also says, as long as the economy remains strong, comma, as long as South Boston real estate remains strong, comma, as long as this, you know, so there's all these caveats, and they may end up being true and we may be fine. But what if we hit another recession? The what if is what concerns me, because unless they can guarantee it, they've taken our money, our taxpayer dollars for a corporation, and it's simply and only for their profit margin.
Jim, are you in the as long as camp?
Look, I completely agree with Arlene. I think the fact is this is not the way to grow your economy. This is not the way we should have done. And I don't think that GE at the end of the day came for those reasons. I think they came because of the workforce and what was already here. What I would say is, you know, if you want to get ahead of ourselves and think about Amazon for a second, right, and say, all right, what lessons did we learn, right? I guess the first thing I'd say is there are clawback provisions in what they did. So that was smarter than just giving them the kitchen and saying, go and do what you need to do. But GE's different. And we would by drawing direct parallels between GE and Amazon, I think we might make a mistake in the sense that it's only 800 people. They were working on a heliport, let's say.
Not 50,000.
Not 50,000 where they need a transportation system. So if we do want to create incentives for Amazon, I would urge folks to think about a heavy investment in signals, infrastructure, the T, because that is the weakest portion of our application in that for HQ2, that and housing. And housing is a little bit of a different issue. But we would be better to promise that we'll put X dollars into the T for the infrastructure than we would be, hey, Amazon, you get tons of money. We're going to give you more.
I am completely on board with that, Jim, because not only would it make Greater Boston a more attractive place for a company like Amazon, but that is an investment that directly has a positive impact on the million people who ride the MBTA every day. So let's talk a little bit more about Amazon, because as we know, this week, Boston made the shortlist of the top 20 locations for Amazon's HQ2. And yesterday, I should say, just to be clear, Amazon didn't put the list out in like rank order. They just said, here's the top 20. But yesterday, reporters asked Boston Mayor Marty Walsh if there were any lessons for Boston from GE regarding Amazon. And here's what Mayor Walsh said.
It's similar in the sense of, obviously, they're monster giant companies, GE and Amazon. But they're different in the sense of GE moved their corporate headquarters from one city to another, to Boston. Amazon is not doing that. Amazon is looking for a second headquarters. And I think if Amazon was going to be down, I don't see any time in the future Amazon going smaller. It seems like they're just getting bigger every day.
That's Marty Walsh channeling Jim Sturgis. Okay, let's hear what Governor Charlie Baker had to say.
I think the fact that Massachusetts continues to be part of the smaller universe with respect to Amazon's decision about where it might choose to locate its second headquarters is just a great statement about the quality of the people, the quality of the institutions, and frankly, the quality of life we have here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Woohoo! Okay. No, I mean, like, look, he's right to cheerlead. He's right to cheerlead. I'm not slighting Governor Baker there. I honestly, he's right to cheerlead. This region has a ton going for it that I think would be very attractive to a company like Amazon. But to this question of incentives, the last time I talked to Mayor Walsh was just before he had put in the bid, and he was kind of coy about whether or not there were any direct incentives. There weren't at the time, but he says he's open. He's open to some negotiations. So just to key off what Jim said earlier, Arlene, what kinds of incentives do you think would best benefit the region and not just Amazon?
Well, that's exactly. I agree with you and with Jim on this one. You know, it's nice to be on the dance card for Amazon. You know, it's flattering and it is seductive to be offered 50,000 good paying jobs. And who's going to say no to that? Except there's some cautionary notes we have to keep in mind, some warning signs. We already have affordable housing problems mm-hmm. on a significant level in the state. Our transportation system is already stressed. Income disparities are already bad enough. What will be the ramifications of having this come? Well, might it be good or might it be bad? I think that there's some arguments that can be made on both sides. But I think Boston has to stop. I think we suffer, a la Shirley's comments in the Globe, a little bit from an inferiority complex. We are an attractive city. We have, you know, the brains, we have the history, we have the sports, we have the culture. And it's the quality of life, as one of you just said, that brings these companies in. So I don't think we need to start courting them with money.
Yeah.
I think we court them with things that benefit society at large, like transportation you were just saying.
I agree, because other people have said this, not one penny unless that money goes to improving fundamentals here. That's vastly need improvement on. And maybe there's an opportunity to partner with Amazon on some of those improvements. Jim, your thoughts on that?
I think they want to do their business is what I think they want to do. I mean, honestly, that's what companies want to do at the end of the day. And the one thing I would say is, look, I am completely in Arlene's camp. We've opposed a number of these incentive programs because they tend not to work over the longer period. You get one hit, yep, but 10 miss, right? The thing I'd say is we want them. Because jobs are great. I'd rather be Boston with a slightly, with a problem with inequality than Springfield without jobs, to be quite honest. If that's the choice we have to make, because jobs lead to more money being put into the community and more jobs for other folks, it's just a better way to go. That's
Jim,
my view.
Jim, you know that we're friends, but I'm gonna badger you here a little bit, because tell that to the Bostonians right now who are paying $2,700 for a postage stamp size one bedroom.
Yep. Understand. What I would also say, just to make you even angrier.
I'm not angry. I'm just channeling the emotions of our listeners.
The only thing I'd say on top of that is you don't start with money. But if at the end of the day you're Atlanta versus Boston and they're putting $200 million on the table and they come to you and say, if you put $300 on the table, what do you choose? For a governor, for a mayor, I hate it. But the reality is, what do you do?
You put $300 million into the MBTA.
Yes, I second that motion.
No, I'm just, you know.
No, well, It would be a nice question to ask if the reality presents itself. So we'll see. All right. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs, and this is the kind of week where I need some good news. So so actually, I don't know if this is good news or bad news. I'm going to start with my hubbub because we're talking about the tea. And Jim, this one's especially for you. This is news that is breaking today. I'm seeing here in the Herald, hat tip to the Boston Herald, that the tea and labor leaders say they've reached a tentative bargaining agreement with the MBTA's union that represents the T's bus mechanics. And this could actually thwart the Baker administration's attempts to partially privatize some of the bus garages here. This has been a long and very thorny negotiation. Look, my browser just crashed. So that's as much as I've got for you. But that breaking news from the Herald. But it's interesting because this was a major change that the Baker administration wanted to try out at the T. Politically problematic, but it looks like they may not even get the chance. Just your quick thought on that?
I haven't seen the details of it, so I really don't know. And I think as part of the negotiation with the Carmen's Union, there was a lot that was really, really good for all sides in that. So it worked out for everybody. I haven't seen the details. It'd be hard to say anything.
Okay, fair enough. I like people who say, I actually want to know what I'm talking about before I talk about it. So, Jim, what about your hubbub?
I will admit that my hubbub, which is supposed to be something below the fold, is well below the fold. It does address a longstanding, in fact, 1,000-year need of Leif Erikson aficionados on this side of the Atlantic. There will be two new axe-throwing bars coming to the greater Boston area in 2018. Congratulations. We are now as hip as Maine and Canada. This news will strike a chord with many, especially firefighters, those with an axe to grind, and those who need a beer and a good cry after getting the axe, not to mention those who are looking for a place to meet bearded guys clad in plaid. Look for one in Union Square, Somerville, where else? And the other in Everett. Further evidence, if any was needed, that Everett has arrived.
Jim, is that your way of saying we'll see you there?
Absolutely. Axe
okay.
in hand.
An axe throwing bar. Great. Arlene, you get to be cleanup hitter today.
I see. Well, mine is on an equally high and noble ground. My hubbub is about the Google Arts and Culture app, which actually apparently has existed since 2016. And at the time, I'm told, it was about articles and features on artists and art history, and it would help a person explore different styles and art during different times in our histories. And apparently now they have added very recently a match your selfie function where you can take your face and match it to famous artwork, find yourself in famous artwork.
Have you done this?
I have not. I have not. So who am I to say any of this? But apparently you can find your artistic doppelganger by downloading this free app. But beware, because you might not like the results. In fact, it's really been quite funny. In the last 48 hours, I've read all these hysterical postings from people I know who have talked about their disappointment and their upset in who they were matched to, which artists and artwork they were matched to. I had a cousin who lives north of Boston in Georgetown who said when she was matched to an unfortunate-looking fellow that they had better pay for the therapy she will now need. So while I think it's wonderful if in fact, this app causes people to learn more about artists and art history. For that, I think it's great, but the other part is hysterical.
Have you done it, Jim?
I haven't, but I have a feeling I'd be St. John the Baptist with my head on the plate.
Like, none of us have done it. I won't do it on principle because I don't want to give a picture of my face to the Google machine. But my favorite one that I've seen online so far is someone had a picture of Clark Kent, and then the Google app matched it 100% to a picture of Superman. Well, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. It's always great to have you, Arlene. Thank you so much. Jim Sturgis, executive director at the Pioneer Institute. Always
nice
great to have you.
You,
too. We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Pope Francis stunned survivors of sexual abuse yesterday in Chile. On the last day of his trip to the country, Francis defended a Chilean bishop saying, quote, The day they bring me proof against Bishop Barros, I'll speak. There is not one shred of proof against him. It's all calumny. Is that clear? Chilean sexual abuse victims claim that Bishop Juan Barros covered up abuse by Father Fernando Caradima. In 2011, Caradima was convicted by the Vatican of abusing teenage boys beginning in the 1980s, and he was ordered to lead a, quote, life of prayer and penitence. A criminal case against him was dropped. Now, Bishop Barros continuously claimed he never saw the abuse and never participated in any cover-up. But joining us now is Anne Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org, a Boston-based group that maintains a database of clergy sexual abuse cases. She was in Chile for the Pope's visit. She joins us today from Lima, Peru. Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Well, what's your reaction to the Pope's very strong words calling accusations against Barros calumny?
It's devastating. It's a devastating setback. This papacy was going to be about restoring trust. The Pope has said repeatedly that he weeps for victims, that he's going to hold bishops accountable. But we knew all along that those were scripted remarks, and unfortunately, he has just turned back the clock to the darkest hours of the clergy abuse crisis. The church has, you know, years of blaming victims. And that's what the Pope did in Chile. It was absolutely stunning, the disappointment.
I mean, I'm seeing here that he began his trip, though, with an apology to Chilean survivors of sexual abuse. But even there, it was somewhat complicated because he said, "I feel bound to express my pain and shame at the irreparable damage caused to children by some ministers of the church. I am one with my brother bishops, though.
Yes.
For it is right to ask for forgiveness and make every effort to support victims, even as we commit ourselves to ensuring that such things do not happen again." How do you read that?
Well, that he was signaling right from the beginning that he was one with his brother bishops. The big issue in Chile, these are informed and weary people. They so want their church leaders held accountable. They have been thoroughly educated by the Caradima survivors that the bishops have been complicit. They see bishops down there openly reinstating priests who've been found guilty either under church law or civil law. I mean, zero tolerance does not exist in the Chilean church. And this was such a test for Pope Francis, such an opportunity, and he absolutely failed,
right.
Resoundingly.
You know, of course, I can't read the Pope's mind, but of course I am mindful of the fact that he's from Argentina, right? Right next door.
Yes.
I mean, is there a particular resonance, a complexity that this takes on with Pope Francis, given the fact that he himself is South American?
Well, it seems it smacks of a stereotype of the autocratic and arrogant South American bishops of old. When the Pope was an archbishop in Argentina, he refused to meet with victims. That is a matter of public record. And in the one case where he intervened, you know, while bishops in Europe and the U.S. were apologizing and meeting with victims, he in Argentina, in as late as 2009, 2010, sided with a convicted predator priest, somebody who'd been convicted for child molestation. That's who this Pope was. We thought the papacy might change him. It doesn't seem to have done that.
Mm. Now, your group, Bishop Accountability, has published a database of 80 or so clergy members in Chile who have been accused
right.
of sexually abusing minors. And in some documentation along with that database, Bishop Accountability says that the grouping reveals the distinctive aspects of the Catholic abuse crisis in Chile and the degree to which it remains hidden. So can you talk to me a little bit about what do you mean by distinctive aspects?
What's distinctive is that the openness, the brazenness with which Chile's bishops and religious superiors reinstate guilty priests. Here in the U.S., there actually is a zero tolerance law that the U.S. bishops really forced the Vatican to let them adopt in 2002 because the pressure there, that was, you know, after the Globe Spotlight investigation or as it was ongoing, and the pressure was overwhelming on the U.S. church. They were scrambling. But that is not a law outside the United States. Inside, you know, what I mean is it's not a church law outside the United States. So here in Chile, I mean, the people are as sophisticated as the people in the U.S. when it comes to this issue, but they see their bishops flouting this zero tolerance standard. And what makes it worse is that Pope Francis repeatedly has promised that zero tolerance is, you know, what he stands for.
And we've just got a few seconds here, but I want to sneak in one more question to you. Kevin Cullen in The Globe just yesterday wrote that, quote, "Let the record show that the promise of Pope Francis died in Santiago, Chile on January 18th. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I think there is almost, this Pope has lost all credibility on this issue. Of course, if he takes some decisive action and starts removing some of the many complicit bishops in the church, he could regain it, but that absolutely is not going to happen. I think what it means, Meghna, is that the accountability has to come from outside the church.
Well, Anne Barrett Doyle is co-director of Bishop Accountability, a Boston-based group that maintains a database of clergy sexual abuse cases. She's speaking to us today from Lima, Peru. Anne, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On March 11th, 1959, A Raisin in the Sun opened on Broadway. It's one of the most important plays in the history of American theater. And it tells the story of the American dream and its limitations for Black Americans. Here's a scene. This is from the 1961 movie version of the play, starring Sidney Poitier and Ruby Dee.
I'm looking in the mirror this morning, and I'm thinking I'm 35 years old. I'm married 11 years, and I got a boy who's got to sleep in the living room because I got nothing, eh?
Nothing to give him but stories, like on how rich white people live, eh?
Eat your eggs, Walt.
Damn these eggs. Damn all the eggs that ever was.
And go to work.
I'm trying to talk to you about me. Now, all you're going to say to me is eat these eggs?
You never said anything new. I listen to you every day, every morning, every night. You never say nothing new. So you'd rather be Mr. Arnold than be his chauffeur. So I'd rather be living in Buckingham Palace.
And that's just what's wrong with a colored woman in this world today. You don't understand about billing your men up, making them feel like they're somebody, like they can do something.
All colored men who do things.
No thanks to the colored woman.
Being a colored woman, I guess I can't help myself now.
A Raisin in the Sun was written by Lorraine Hansberry. She was a profoundly intelligent, politically radical, and emotionally perspicacious 28-year-old when the play first came to New York. Hansberry was also an unflinching artistic critic of American life. Here she is in 1959 on the television show Look Up and Live. She'd been asked if she thought it was a compliment that some people considered A Raisin in the Sun to be not a Negro play at all, in the words of the presenter, but a play about people.
It's a misstatement. It's very much a play about people, but it's also a play about Negroes in the first place. I've said very often that I think that you achieve the universal through the specific.
Yes.
And it certainly is a protest, perhaps not in the traditional form. That's what they mean, I hope. But it is more than a protest in that I did try to suggest that there is something to do, that it is possible to take principled positions in our lives.
Lorraine Hansberry died in 1965. She was just 34 years old. A new documentary airing on PBS Tonight explores that remarkable life. It's called Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart. And documentary director Tracy Heather Strain joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
It's a riveting, riveting couple of hours of television. I absolutely loved watching it. So let me just ask you the most basic question. Yes, Lorraine Hansberry has a remarkable life, but what drew you to it specifically? What made you want to tell her story?
It was Hansberry's words. I was first introduced to them when I was 17, which is about 40 years ago. And they just hit me, as they do many people. And I was living in the suburbs of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I had never encountered a young Black woman who thought things similar to me. And so she stayed in my head for years until I decided to become a filmmaker and decided I wanted to make a film about Lorraine Hansberry. And I can't believe it actually happened.
Well, I think one of the things I enjoyed the most is that I learned so much in watching this about her earliest years, which I didn't know about, and her remarkable family, particularly her father in Chicago. Obviously, he is a force that sort of thunders throughout her life, even after he died. But can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Carl Augustus Hansberry, Lorraine Hansberry's father, was a migrant from the South and came to Chicago and started. He worked at a bank that he helped found. He did all sorts of things, including he started collecting rents, and then that developed into him buying up properties and dividing them up and making kitchenettes, which is the kind of housing unit you see in the play A Raisin mm-hmm. in the Sun. And so this is like the ground where this is where Lorraine gets all of her ideas that end up in A Raisin in the Sun. She's in this empowered Chicago community of African Americans, and her father's a leader. He's working towards making change for African Americans. He's a member of many civic organizations, and he ends up taking a case all the way to the Supreme Court. They buy a house in a previously all-white street. They're forced to leave.
Well, violently forced to leave.
Yeah. Yes, yes. The mother's guarding the house with a loaded German Luger, according to Lorraine. And her sister in our documentary tells a story that Lorraine was in the house and someone threw a piece of mortar through the window and it almost hit 7-year-old Lorraine. So these were really impressionable things. But she really was a daddy's girl. She loved him, and she thought he was someone that was always doing something special and unusual. And it was a great inspiration for mm-hmm. her.
And so she goes to, unfortunately, he passes away. And I don't want to give away the whole story because there's an interesting move before that. Mm-hmm. But he passes away. She goes to college, but then goes to New York and works at Harlem, you know, in this incredible community of Black activists and intellectuals. She's writing radical journalism, which seemed incredibly – I'm looking at it now thinking, we need stories like that published today. But what led her to playwriting, though?
It seems that it was, you know, that was the medium of the age, first of all. But I think that journalism wasn't doing it for her. I mean, in some ways, Freedom Magazine was like preaching to the converted. And she was working with people like Paul Robeson, who had been on Broadway in Othello in the 40s. And Alice Childress had been on Broadway in Anna Lucasta. So she's around people who are both writers, activists, and theater people. So, but one day she sees a play. We tried to figure out what play it was that just made her angry, and about how Negroes were, as she said, Negroes at that time were represented. And she said, "I'm going to write a play that's realistic about Black people." And that's a paraphrase of what she said. But and so she starts in, you know, writing Raisin in the Sun. This woman taught herself how to write a play. She didn't study playwriting somewhere. And like everything she did, she applied herself, she read, and she practiced.
I mean, astonishing talent, right? Mm-hmm. She's what, in her mid-20s? Late 26,
she's like 27. Yeah,
when she's writing this. Mm-hmm. How did it come to the attention of Sidney Poitier? Because he starred in the first stage production as well.
Yes. So first of all, it was her friend from the left, Phil Rose, decided to produce it. And Phil Rose used to play poker with Sidney Poitier. And Sidney had been on a record that Phil Rose had produced. He was a record producer. And so that's how it got to Sidney. And Sidney was key to the funding, even though it was very hard to fund. It kind of was like an early Kickstarter campaign almost, because the donations were so small for getting Raisin in the Sun onto Broadway.
She, the play is, it's well received, to say the least. And then, as you said, it moves to Broadway. But you also talk about how much was at stake, because it was the first of its kind it's like an honest entry into the interior lives of Black Americans. And there's someone that you have in the documentary who says that, like, there was so much at stake that what did the person say? That, like, the
if this didn't hit then we wouldn't have one of these for a long time.
Yeah,
Margaret Wilkerson, who's writing a biography of Lorraine Hansberry. Yeah, we were really trying to make the documentary feel like the tension that our the people we interviewed shared with us. They were so nervous because people didn't want to believe that white people would relate to a drama about African Americans. Yeah. And so many people, that's why it was hard to fund it, and that's why people didn't want to give him a theater. And so, and then everyone thought if it didn't make it after all the tryouts, then nobody else was going to get a shot. Fortunately, right. That didn't happen.
No, I mean, she won the highest theater award in New York. The line was the image of a whole race of people was at stake. That really stayed with me. We just got a couple of seconds left here, Tracy. Lorraine Hansberry died at 34. I mean, talk about a talent cut short. Just got a couple seconds. Do you ever think to yourself, what more might she have done?
I always think about that. And she was working on so many different things, and it's just such a shame.
Well, but at least tonight on PBS, I strongly encourage people to watch this documentary because you really get a sense of how remarkable her life was. And we barely touched the surface. Tracy Heather Strain, director of the documentary Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart. Again, it airs tonight on PBS. We have information about it at our website, radioboston.org. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today, everyone. Have a great and peaceful weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.